We begin our program tonight by introducing two guests, and I'm very happy to welcome to our program tonight Joseph Gerson. He's with the American Friends Service Committee, and he's the disarmament coordinator for AFSC, Director of New England Programs, and the group's Peace and Economy Security Program. Dan Jasper is also on the line with us. He's with the American Friends Service Committee's Public Education and Advocacy Coordinator for Asia. I want to thank you both for joining us tonight on our Counterpoint program. Joseph and Dan, are you there?
We're here. Thank you so much.
Okay. And do I have you both on the line, Joseph and Dan? Oh, you know what? We seem to have lost. We seem to have lost Joseph. I'm not sure what happened there. I am going to hope he calls back. But you know what I'll do, Dan? I'm going to ask you to maybe talk a bit about the American Friends Service Committee operations that you work on public education and advocacy. And I'll try and get Joseph back on the line. Okay?
Sure. Sounds okay. Good. Well, American Friends Service Committee actually has a really long history working in Korea. We actually were one of the first organizations to answer the UN call for refugee assistance following the war in 1953. We stayed on the peninsula for about 5 years helping refugee assistance, and then we left. But we stayed engaged in the region and with the sort of entrenched conflict. Later in 1980, we were actually the first U.S. public affairs organization to enter North Korea, partially out of concern for some of the divided families that were still seeking to reunite with loved ones. And the other part of that, too, is that we were concerned that the conflict really hadn't come to a resolve even after what was then about 30 years. The AFSC stayed engaged after that initial delegation, and it allowed us to carry out a number of exchange programs and peace delegations to North Korea. That in and of itself was significant because it allowed us to maintain contact with a number of channels inside North Korea. So when famine hit in the late 90s, AFSC was actually one of the first organizations to identify that as a concern and to start to raise funds and relief for the famine. So after the famine, we stayed engaged, and we sought to address food security on a more basic level, at the agricultural level. So today, we actually have a very successful agricultural assistance program that runs. My job, working in D.C., is really to bring home lessons that we learn working with North Koreans back to policymakers in D.C. And so there's a number of things, I think, that we're learning working at the humanitarian level that sort of offer themselves up to policymakers in D.C. And I'm happy to get into that if you're ready.
Thank you very much, Dan. You know, what I think what I'll do is, because I got Joseph back on the line, I'll have Joseph address some of the work that he does at the American Friends Service Committee before we get into our topic and some of the things I know you want to talk about. But, Joseph, welcome to the program. Thank you for making time to be here with us.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about the work you do at AFSC.
Well, the work I've done, I should be clear, I'm speaking sort of in two contexts on this call. One, my role with the American Friends Service Committee, and then also with the new organization we're forming called the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. Within the AFSC, you know, I go back to helping to launch the nuclear weapons freeze movement back in about 1979, and been working on nuclear weapons issues over this time. I've done a lot of work in basically trying to help people understand not only what nuclear weapons do, but various paths for nuclear disarmament and to prevent nuclear war. We've held numerous conferences, we've hosted delegations, I've traveled to Japan and other countries and done this kind of work. Just this weekend, as part of a international campaign to back what's called the Nuclear Prohibition Treaty, signed by 122 countries back in July, we participated in what was an international peace wave with actions taking place around the world to help call attention to this new treaty and to build support for it. And here in Boston, we had probably about 7,500 people who joined in actions that also took place to other parts of the country and around the world.
Well, thank you.
And here in, just to say that here in the Boston area, in the context of this crisis with North Korea, we've been holding or planning a number of educational events to help people understand the issues so that we can impact our policymakers. Our call is just really quite basic. It's time to negotiate. It's long past time to negotiate. Direct negotiations are necessary. And, you know, we can lead us back off of the brink of this confrontation, which is extremely dangerous.
Thank you both for the introductions and the work you do with the American Friends Service Committee. I was just going to take a couple of minutes here to talk about some of the very alarming exchanges we've had between Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. And I think I'm just reviewing stuff that a lot of people are listening know about or know pieces of. But at a speech before the United Nations General Assembly last Tuesday, Donald Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea. Those exact words, totally destroy. If the United States was forced to defend itself or an ally, he later tweeted North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was obviously a madman and he would be tested like never before, quote unquote. Kim replied by issuing a video statement where he said Trump would pay dearly for his threats and accused him of being mentally deranged. North Korea threatened to test a nuclear weapon over the Pacific Ocean. On Saturday, Trump tweeted that if North Korea's foreign minister echoed the thoughts of President Kim at the United Nations, they won't be around much longer. Quote, they won't be around much longer. To which the foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, said that Trump had declared war on his country and that North Korea had every right to make self-defensive countermeasures. This past weekend, the U.S. flew B-1 bombers and F-15 fighter jets off the coast of North Korea, the furthest north American warplanes had been flown in many years. So this war of words is quite concerning. We have two leaders that, in the estimation of a lot of sane people, are very unstable folks. And there is, I think there's a lot of uncertainty here about where this will lead. I would ask you, Joseph, first of all, to place in context for us this kind of match of insults that is more worthy of middle school students than presidents.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say you broke up a little bit in the call, but just to say, I mean, this is not the most mature action that we can expect of our leaders, and it's really quite disturbing and frightening. I mean, my concern is that we find a situation in which the words that these leaders have expressed create political realities from which they can't back off. Some of your listeners will remember that back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, at one point, President Kennedy turned to his brother, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, and said, you know, if I hadn't taken this crisis, if I hadn't ratcheted up this crisis, I would be impeached. And so I think it's important for all people who are concerned, really ultimately about human survival, to be weighing in on our congressional representatives, our opinion makers and otherwise, saying, look, the obvious way forward on this is to negotiate. I mean, if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, what you find is that even then Secretary of Defense McNamara said early in the crisis, look, it's not worth it because in time Russia will have ICBMs that can reach us. And we're in a situation where in some ways the actions of North Korea in developing its nuclear weapons have their own logic. I mean, obviously, no country should possess nuclear weapons, given what they could do. But the reality is that North Korea has been threatened with nuclear attack by the United States somewhere between 9 and 12 times. And in this circumstance, it's moved to create a nuclear arsenal, I think, largely to deter the threats from the United States. And the way forward, obviously, is to sit down and negotiate some form of non-aggression. People talk in terms of freeze for freeze, some form of a diplomatic way forward, which is precisely what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis when cooler heads prevailed.
Thank you for that, Joseph. Dan Jasper, I'd ask you to give your read on this very alarming situation and the possibility that we may have very grave, unintentional, and unanticipated consequences that could grow out of this war of words.
Yeah, well, you know, just to build off of what Joseph was saying, I think you really hit the mark. And in fact, I think what Trump is missing is that there's a lot of history there with North Korea specifically. In fact, you know, the U.S. basically totally destroyed North Korea during the Korean War. And so when the Koreans hear this, what they really hear is a hearkening back to the history that they live every day. We call it the Forgotten War. But in fact, you know, the war was never ended. And in fact, we're a big country. We've sort of moved on in a lot of ways, but North Korea sort of lives this every day. And, you know, I've been there and I feel you can sort of get a sense of the siege mentality that exists there. And you can look across the border and you see the UN flag flying with the US flag. And you do get the sense that they feel, besieged and that they feel the need to protect themselves. Where we are here, or at this moment, I think you're right in that miscalculation and error are some of the biggest problems we're facing right now and potentials for catastrophe. I don't want to put a sort of percentage or probability on what could happen. I think we're all aware that it's a very dangerous situation. But what I would really like to underscore here is that there's a number of sort of politically viable and face-saving options here that the U.S. and North Korea can pursue to sort of cool things down a bit. One of those might be, about 8,000 U.S. servicemen, missing service U.S. servicemen, were left in North Korea following the war. In the past, there were operations between the U.S. and North Korean military to locate those remains and to bring them back to the United States. Sadly, that operation was discontinued during the Bush era, but it's something that remains viable today. In fact, we know that the North is interested in something like this, and for reasons of, you know, the fact that if we're cooperating, you know, if they're cooperating together, the likelihood of military conflict is greatly reduced. This is also a great measure to sort of to skirt this rhetorical corner that they've backed themselves into by finding some sort of humanitarian gesture that can ratchet things down a bit. Another option would be reuniting Korean-American families with their family members in North Korea. There's about 100,000 Korean-Americans that came to the United States that were divided after the war. It's estimated that around 3,000 of them are still alive, and many of them are still seeking to reunite with their family members in North Korea. So if we were to start some sort of reunion program, even just a pilot program where perhaps, you know, 10 families went over there to see their family members that they haven't seen in over six decades, think of the powerful imagery that could produce, and really give the space necessary to the leaders, to leaders of both countries, to find a diplomatic solution here, or at least to lay the groundwork for political dialogue.
So just, I think, one thing that is lost in the moment is the reality that you negotiate with your enemies, not necessarily with your friends, and to appreciate that. For example, the Soviet Union at one point had as many as 15,000 nuclear weapons as did the United States. We were faced with the possibility of the end of all human life. In the midst of that confrontation, negotiations took place to reduce the tensions and to begin building back the arsenals on both sides.
Joseph,
so I think we can be advocating negotiations without blinking away, you know, how intense this conflict is.
Joseph, I wanted to interrupt you. Joseph?
It's possible even to go far enough toward the creation of a nuclear weapons-free Northeast Asia.
Joseph, I just wanted to ask you on that very point. It's been said by our politicians as well as commentators, that the leadership of North Korea is not rational, is irrational, not to be trusted, and, you know, basically saying they're on a suicide mission of some kind. But I would ask you this. What's the basic framework for possible negotiations that could be kicked off? And I know North Korea has made statements basically saying that they want an end to the Korean War, as Dan had said earlier. They also want normalized diplomatic relations. Is there any way that the United States, along with China, which, you know, has provided vital resources to North Korea, could push this agenda at this point, or are things too frayed and angry?
Well, I think in any negotiations, you know, things move maybe slower than one would want. But, you know, if you go back, I mean, as early, you know, maybe 20 years ago, Scott Snyder of the Asia Foundation was writing about the rationality within North Korea's actions. And former Secretary of Defense Perry has talked about this more recently. And people should remember that Perry and Secretary of State Albright essentially negotiated a comprehensive agreement with North Korea in 1999 and 2000, which was basically thrown out, not fulfilled by the Bush administration early on. I think we need to recognize that the two primary concerns of the North Korean leadership is preservation of the Kim dynasty and preservation of North Korean sovereignty. I mean, those are its bottom lines. And certainly we can negotiate within those frameworks. I mean, we certainly have relationships with more than a few dictatorships around the world. We might begin with Saudi Arabia, but there's a bunch of others as well. So I think we can move to negotiations. Getting to the point of replacing the armistice with a peace agreement will take some time in negotiations, but you build from step to step, as you build trust, through the negotiations.
Well, Joseph, I want to just get one more comment from you, and we're running out of time, and I'll give you the last word. But, Joseph, I wanted to ask you, this. There's a lot of concern about Donald Trump and his fitness for office. And people around the country have placed a lot of hope in the generals that surround Donald Trump, General John Kelly, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Joseph Dunford, and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. There's a lot of faith put in them that they're going to prevent Donald Trump from making any reckless moves that could cost a lot of lives in the Korea Peninsula or here in the United States.
Situation here, where I think there's even a recent ABC and CNN poll indicating that most Americans trust the generals more than they do Trump. And, you know, we in a sense, we face a constitutional crisis because we've always, our Constitution provides for civilian control over the military. If you go back, for example, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you can see some of the dangers of having the military in control. So one will hope that through some kind of dynamic between the generals and Trump and our other political leaders, that Trump can be walked back from this perch on which he's placed us all.
And I would ask you, Dan Jasper, just to give us your final thoughts on optimism, pessimism, a way forward that can avoid catastrophe.
Yeah, well, you know, I remarked on a few things that a few diplomatic tools that exist to ratchet down tensions. I guess, you know, I'll end with a twist, and I'll say that perhaps there should be some credit due to this administration in one important regard, and that is that there is an active channel of communication between the U.S. and North Korea. It's primarily through Ambassador Joseph Yoon. This isn't something that's discussed much, but we do see it reported on. And I want to say that we should really be encouraging this and really sort of paying attention that this channel does exist and that there are ambassadors working diligently to avoid catastrophe. So I just want to sort of lift that up and say that, you know, there are channels happening here, but we do need to sort of empower them a little bit, and we do sort of need to provide them tools to move forward. They exist, and we hope that they pursue them soon.
And Dan, leave us with the web address and some of the resources that are available at the American Friends Service Committee website. or other places?
Yeah, you can find us at AFSC.org, and there's a number of publications that we've done recently called Engaging North Korea. Our most recent one is Engaging North Korea Volume 2, and this outlines a number of humanitarian engagements that we see as viable steps forward that can de-escalate tensions right now.
And Joseph, you mentioned a new group that you're working with, the Campaign for Peace and Common Security, or say the full name and how people can find out more about that.
At this point, the best way is just to be in touch with me directly at jgerson80@gmail.com. We're in the process of creating our webpage.
And what's the name of it? Campaign for Peace? What was it?
It's Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security. Common Security is the frame of reference that was used to end the Cold War, and it's one that would be usefully applied in the current crisis with North Korea.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both, Joseph Gerson and Dan Jasper, both of the American Friends Service Committee, and I hope we can stay on in touch on this and many of the other issues that you guys work on. So thanks for being here with us tonight.
Thank you for doing what
thanks
you
so
do.
Much.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's, again, Joseph Gerson, American Friends Service Committee's Disarmament Coordinator, and Dan Jasper, American Friends Service Committee's Public Education and Advocacy Coordinator for Asia.